It's Wednesday, July the 22nd, and you are very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. This is usually the time of year when the world of politics starts winding down for a few weeks, but not much sign of that right now, I think. Among the live subjects this week, the hard-fought EU budgetary deal agreed in Brussels on Monday, the government's impending rescue package for an economy struck low by COVID-19, deepening concerns about what the situation will be for students who are returning to schools and colleges in the autumn, and the not insignificant question of the Green Party leadership contest, the result of which is imminent. We are going to try to get through at least some of that with our political editor, Pat Leahy. Hi, Pat.
Morning, Hugh.
And a new addition to our politics team, Jack Horgan-Jones. Hi, Jack.
Morning, Hugh.
Good to have you on board. I'm going to turn, first of all, to the subject which seems to have been preoccupying most people over the last 24 hours, which is this question of a green list of countries to which people may travel without the restrictions of self-isolation when they return from those countries in Ireland. The whole thing seemed to turn into a bit of a mess over the last few days.
Yeah, so the whole idea of some form of less onerous restriction on travel is actually, it's not new in that it stretches back to something the previous government wanted to introduce. This idea of air bridges is actually not even a particularly Irish invention. It's something that other countries around the world have been instituting, whereby you kind of match up the rate of progression of the disease basically with another jurisdiction overseas, and based on that you initiate a less restrictive kind of travel regime around it. Now, it sounds simple in practice, but it effectively, the government has managed to make the most kind of enormous mess of it, not just in the last couple of days, but in the days leading up to it. I mean, the message they would have wanted to press here would have been, on the one hand, the disease is getting progressively under control in Ireland, and we are moving towards a kind of semi-normalized situation, which is important from a kind of outwards looking economic messaging point of view. You know, Ireland is in favor of the free movement of goods, services, people, money, and you know, we need to maintain connectivity and all that other stuff. But they would have also wanted to maintain this idea that, you know, public health was the prime organizing principle and the prime motivating factor behind everything that they were doing. And in the course of affairs, due to the confusion about how the green list system is actually going to operate, they've managed to totally lose track of the messaging on both those things. Like, they have a green list now, consisting of countries that either we don't fly to or you wouldn't want to go to. And you ask any passing public health official, you know, should we be instituting this in any way, shape or form? And they would say, on the balance of things, no. And we should also be doing much harder things like mandatory quarantine for people who arrive. So the message, the whole policy really has gotten away from them. And on top of that, it's exposed a cleavage between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, thanks to Leo Varadkar's intervention yesterday, when he said effectively that there was no point in introducing a green list unless you were going to also change some of the travel advice, some of the specific travel advice that related to the countries on that list. And it all led to this marathon cabinet meeting last night, when they announced the list of 15 countries, and to profound indifference of nearly everyone watching, and ongoing confusion, because you know there's questions also about how onerous the restrictions are going to be. You know, this list is going to be reviewed every 2 weeks, so it's possibly something that may actually not be killed off yet, and may come back to bite them again in the future.
I mean, Pat, I suppose, one of the points Jack is making there, you can see how this kind of structure and approach is going to be, or might well be, useful in the months and perhaps the years ahead, as we're dealing in a more long-term way with travel between different countries. But it was a real mess yesterday. Alan Kelly, the Labour leader, jumped on it, saying he was wondering who the Taoiseach was because of the comments which the Tánaiste had made outside the Dáil. I was listening to Simon Coveney wriggling like a worm in a hook on Morning Ireland this morning, trying to answer questions about what happens if you go to Gibraltar or San Marino or Monaco or one of those countries which barely have airports at all, so you need to travel through another country to get to them in the first place. I don't know if you're planning your holidays in Greenland, but I am not. I mean, the bottom line is, isn't it, that non-essential travel continues to be not recommended, and the only difference between the countries on this list and the countries that are not on this list is you are not required to self-isolate for 14 days coming into the country from those countries.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's not that confusing in that it is possible to understand what the government are saying with regard to its travel advice and this list of countries. But I'm not sure why they're doing it. And several people that I'd spoken to in government over the previous few days weren't sure either. And there was a strong argument put in government, which I think Leo Varadkar recognised in his unusual comments yesterday, and I'll come to those in a minute. But his suggestion was, if your travel advice isn't changing, then why do this green list at all? Eliminating the requirement to quarantine, which, let us not forget, is not really effectively policed at all from this list of countries, is not going to kickstart the Irish tourist industry. I mean, the big tourist markets, the UK, the US, they're still, much of continental Europe, they are still going to be required to quarantine for 14 days, even though, as I say, this isn't effectively policed or, insofar as I can see, implemented. So I don't understand really why the government is doing this if it wishes to retain its pretty strict regulations and restrictions on travel, which it says it's going to do. There are a couple of other things I think to be said for it. One is that a late night cabinet meeting with an uncertain outcome is rarely a sign of a harmonious government with a forward looking agenda. It seems to me that it sends out all the wrong signals about this government, which has yet really to truly find its feet and to articulate both a common purpose and an ability to move forward together towards that common purpose. The second thing I think to say is related to that, and it's that the intervention of Leo Varadkar yesterday, in advance of a cabinet discussion on this issue and a decision, for a cabinet minister to lay out his position and misgivings about the previous behaviour of the government, which is what I think he was doing, talking about mixed messages, registers to me some questions about the coherence of that government. To summarise, I don't really think the government can keep going like this, with with this sort of lack of coherence, and that I think it needs to get its stuff together on this, or it will damage its authority on this subject, and it will also increase the strains and tensions which apparently already exist between its constituent parts.
Yeah, just to follow up with you on that, Pat, I was actually in Dublin Airport on Sunday, and the place is like a morgue. There's very few people coming through. Indeed, there were far more staff than there were people travelling. So it seems to me this is not, the matter itself is not a matter of huge urgency. There are not people flooding into the country or flooding out of the country for that matter right now. So the greater concern is the ability of the government, this more complex government arrangement now, this three-party coalition, to take the more complex challenges which we are now faced with at this stage of the pandemic and to deal with them in a coherent way. And the signs aren't good. Is there an actual policy difference here? Is Fine Gael adopting a more small L liberal approach to measures and Fianna Fáil taking a more cautious or conservative approach?
I think broadly speaking, that is true. There are Fine Gael ministers who are more cautious, but the Taoiseach, the former Taoiseach, and now Tánaiste, Minister for Business, Leo Varadkar, is not amongst them. There are Fianna Fáil ministers who are a little more relaxed about it, but they don't include, as far as I can see, the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, nor the Taoiseach, who are, as you would probably expect new ministers to be, are quite cautious on the matter. The reopening and the accelerated reopening was one of the final things that Fine Gael did when it was in charge of the government. Now it is sharing that authority in government, and there is clearly, I think, and you know, people at the centre of government have confirmed this to me, there is a difference between the two parties. That is not necessarily an insurmountable difficulty as the government goes forward. There were differences in the last cabinet as well, between whatever you want to call them, the hawks and the doves, or the cautious and the slightly more liberal in their approach. What is important, though, is that once it decides, and in fact before it decides, really, that the government speaks with one voice and with to a clear agenda. And I don't think you could fairly say that that's been happening over recent days.
I wonder, Jack, does this bit of a mess actually relate to the fact that the negotiations in Brussels, where Micheál Martin was for longer than expected over the course of a long weekend and very tortuous negotiations, which we're going to go into in a moment, did that maybe just throw the planned schedule for this week? And I don't know if it's a question of eye off the ball, but his attention was diverted elsewhere.
It did and it didn't. Like, I mean, from a kind of comms point of view, if you were working in government, you'd be looking at this week and saying, right, okay, Monday we're going to have the stimulus plan announcement, and then shortly after that we'll have the green list, and it's all going to go swimmingly. And then obviously you have the kind of mega summit in Brussels, which keeps Micheál over there until early this week, you know. So that kind of throws that out the window. But like, I don't think you can blame the logistical overspill of your man having to spend a few extra days over at the commission. You know, I don't think that can carry all the blame for this. Like, at the end of the day, what's going to be the key message that everyone takes out of this? It's going to be that the government, through a series of missteps, has sowed more confusion on an issue that tangibly impacts the lives of voters. And they're going to look back and they're going to say, right, okay, we're 3 or 4 weeks into the lifetime of this government now. We've had, like, the Cromwell cabinet, we've had Cowangate, and now we've had this travel issue. I mean, about the only, in inverted commas, win the government has had so far has been Apple, and that's the one that they've had absolutely precisely nothing to do with, because it was in the hands of lawyers and judges in Brussels. So, you know, I think this plays into a central theme which is emerging from this government, that while it's not kind of teetering on the verge of collapse or anything like that, it's not doing a very good job, and it increases the pressure on senior cabinet ministers and on Micheál Martin to deliver a win, to do something on something visible and tangible that impacts people's lives quite quickly. You know, I would suggest maybe something on insurance, where there was a high-powered meeting of senior ministers last week, would be a good candidate, or something like childcare, you know, because at the moment they look to be kind of floundering, and they're facing into a remarkably difficult series of events, you know, not just, you know, how to manage the pandemic, but also how to reopen schools, how to reopen non-COVID care and hospitals. So, like, now is the time very much to get the act together and to show very clearly and very concretely that the act is together.
Although, Pat, it is arguable that the government had a win of sorts this week, and it is arguable how much input it had into that win, in the fact that a deal was agreed in Brussels for the EU budget for the next 7 years, which means a sort of at the very least, a level of stability is assured in European politics and European finances over the next while, and the markets and all of that. And also, it's a really significant moment, not necessarily because of the amount of money that's been agreed, but because of the move finally, which has been called for many years by some people, from the EU's not just being a setting monetary policy, but setting budgetary policy as well, and actually giving grants to member states.
Yeah, I'd go along with a lot of that. I think that the agreement in Brussels is, by some distance, the most important event of the week. It may turn out to be the most important event politically of the year. It's a step change for the EU to raise common debt, combined with the departure of the British from the EU. I think there is the possibility of significantly greater integration underpinned by fiscal integration over the future. That may bring Ireland in directions, particularly with relation to taxation, that we find significantly uncomfortable. But I think that is likely to be the direction of travel because of the agreement reached this week. Another way of looking at it is that if you thought about the consequences of not reaching an agreement are of a meaningless fudge this week, I think they would possibly have been ruinous in the medium term for the whole EU project. So I think it's hard to play down the significance, and we have a number of pieces in today's paper discussing it. I think it's hard to play down the significance of the agreement reached this week. For Ireland's point of view, I think we report on this in this morning's paper, the resources that will come to Ireland are not all that significant. It's 1.3 billion now. There will be additions to that. There's a special Brexit fund of 5 billion, much of which ministers and officials hope will end up in Ireland. And there's a couple of other funds that Ireland can potentially tap. And it should be bear in mind that that 1.3 billion is out of 70% of the total rather than 100% of the total. And it's for 2021, 2022. There may be further funding available in 2023. But not to get bogged down in the detail of that, I think the important thing for Ireland is the bigger picture, and that is the direction of the EU. And I think that has taken a decisive turn this week.
I mean, Ireland is and will continue to be a net contributor as one of the richer members of the EU, Jack. I mean, a lot of reports today and yesterday following the deal point to the fact that, you know, if the EU is now going to be disbursing money on this kind of scale, it also needs to raise money on a scale. So there are initial discussions, are going to take a while to see what they're going to look like, about whether there'll be EU-wide taxes. I saw mention of a tax on plastics, for example, or something that would be of more concern to any Irish government, a digital tax.
Yeah, it's the kind of, it's the bogeyman, isn't it? Taxation re-enters the room. This is interesting, and it harks back to the Apple case, right? Because had we lost the Apple case and been forced to appeal it again, it would have been another kind of string to the bow of the argument that Ireland is an international tax vagabond, you know, and that we need to have manners put on us, and that any and all measures that might be deployed in order to do that to Ireland and to a few other people in the rogues gallery like Luxembourg and the Dutch and so on would be legitimate. And I think then you might see a kind of a no holds barred policy approach over in Brussels, and you would see all sorts of nasty things like the CCCTB and other acronyms re-emerging, which frankly, you know, people on Merrion Street are terrified of, because it has the capacity not only to decimate our tax base, but also undermine that kind of FDI proposition. Because we won, like it has bought us some breathing room. It has also exhausted potentially one of the main tools that the European Commission had to come after after tax quote unquote rogue states, which is to use competition law. That no longer looks like something they're gonna be able to use fruitfully. Does it mean that the war is over? Absolutely not. I mean, the direction of travel on this is more than clear. And there will be more efforts. In fact, there already was one launched last week. There will be more efforts launched by Brussels to kind of combat multinational tax evasion. And we are a cog in that wheel, as we well know. The question is whether Ireland can be successful in its policy on this matter, successful in the future in its policy on this matter, which has been kind of to kill these issues with kindness, to take part in the multilateral agendas, particularly at a global level through the OECD against tax planning, but in doing so, to use that as a kind of cover and say, well, you know, we're a team player and we're moving towards this, but it can only be done on a global scale. And therefore, this very good and very harmful idea that you're peddling right now, you know, that's terrible. That's just unilateral action. That's not collegiate. And you know, would you ever go away and put that back in the box? So I think that the direction travel is absolutely clear. But we have a better chance of our strategy of kind of delaying, slowing things down, but not being seen to be a total blocker of these efforts succeeding in the medium term. Long term, we are going to have to accept that international taxation is changing. And with that, I think that will mean a kind of deeper strategic rethink about industrial policy and perhaps a nuts and bolts rethink about tax revenues and what we might do if, even to a kind of small to medium percentage, some of those corporation tax revenues evaporate. And that's something that we might, or certainly I would hope, that we would see in around the kind of launch of the National Economic Plan around the time of the budget, which is the last and most kind of long-term part of the COVID response strategy. So be expecting, or at least hoping to see something in that then.
Just to come in on the points that Jack was making there, I think he's right that there is, and it is the thing that Pascal Donohue has often referred to that keeps him awake at night, is the possibility of sudden or otherwise changes in how multinational corporations pay their taxes. Clearly, Ireland's been a huge beneficiary in the way they have arranged their tax affairs over the last few decades. But that is changing, as Jack has outlined. And it is changing at a time when one of the effects of the pandemic and the state's response to the pandemic is going to be a public desire for a bigger state. So aside altogether from the immediate impacts this year and next of paying for the costs of the crisis, so paying for the welfare costs and the health costs, it seems to me that there will be one of the legacies of the pandemic will be of a bigger state, that is to say, a health service that is better prepared for these sort of things and therefore costs more, a welfare system that is able to handle a large number of long-term unemployed or medium-term unemployed people, as we seem to be faced with, as the crisis recedes. So there will be a demand for a bigger state, therefore a more expensive state, and one that requires greater levels of taxation from wherever they come into the future. And if that is happening at the same time that corporation tax receipts, which have been bolstering the exchequer right through this crisis, notwithstanding the huge costs that have also been appended from the crisis, then I think this government and future governments are going to have some, you know, they're going to have some very difficult circles to square. One point to add about the significance of the EU deal, though, I think, is that there are essentially two parts to it. People are talking about the 1.8 trillion, but the greater part of that is just the EU's budget for the next 7 years, into which Ireland's contributions will increase assuming our GDP continues to increase. And into that, Ireland is now a net contributor. The other part of it, which is the special pandemic part, that's the 750 billion fund. That actually won't cost us anything, at least in the short term, because it will be financed by borrowing done jointly by the member states. Now, over time, that debt, of course, will have to be refinanced and serviced. But for now, that is something pretty approaching to free money.
I was going to say, I'm conscious that we, and by we, I often mean I in this instance, tend to very quickly default to talking about the kind of the parish pump elements of what happens at these grand summits in the EU. And of course, they are vitally important, as you've just described. But there's also, we are all members of the EU, and this is a really significant change to the nature of that entity, it seems to me. It moves it to some degree closer to being recognisably having the powers that we associate with a nation state. And within that, that's going to have effects on everything that you guys have just been talking about in terms of fiscal policy and taxation policy. It seems to me to be the first real expression of a post-UK EU. I see Bridget Laffan in today's Irish Times suggesting that this would have been vetoed by the UK had they still been in there. There's the unresolved question, deliberately unresolved, of what to happen about creeping authoritarianism in certain Eastern EU countries, and that's going to form a huge part of EU politics over the next while. I mean, is it a step change in that kind of way, you know, the kind of thing that only happens every decade or decade and a half in the long, tortuous history of the common market, the EC and the EU?
I think it is. I think it's a very big move. I mean, it has popularly been touted as the EU's Hamilton moment, which, you know, is the time that the EU became the subject of a hit musical, and
we're still waiting for the hit musical.
You might be waiting, I suspect. I've attended many summits in the past, and it is hard to think of anything further from a Broadway musical. However, I think if you step back, and you know, one of the jobs that we always have to do when interpreting politics, I think, is to try and separate, you know, the daily and the weekly and the ephemeral from the truly significant, you know, what to try and figure out what are the things that we will still consider important when looking back at the end of the year, say. And I think this is one of those moments. The EU progresses forward in two ways, slowly and incrementally, and then in big jumps like the single market and the single currency. And I think this is likely to be a move forward towards greater integration on a par with the creation of the single market through the single European Act, through the single currency. There are, of course, there are lots of pitfalls ahead, and there are lots of ways that this could come apart. The difficulty in putting together the deal over recent days is testament to that. But I think the important thing is the agreement was reached. The Franco-German motor appears to be running again, and it is propelling the EU forward in an integrationist direction that I think is significantly assisted by this move, and is probably irrevocable now.
I mean, what's even more interesting, you know, in given what Pat has just said, is the fact that this has occurred at a moment in Europe's political history when the whole idea of the European Union, the whole idea of ever closer union, has been kind of fundamentally challenged, not only by the emergence of Eurosceptic blocks within domestic politics around the EU, but also in some instances in the emergence of you know, Eurosceptic governments or governments which include Eurosceptic parties. You know, so it is slightly baffling in some ways that they've managed to get this away. And I think that speaks to a wider truth about the kind of the profound power of crisis. You know, if crisis presents, on the one hand, remarkable human suffering and death tolls and so on, it also presents a chance to achieve really profound and lasting political, economic and so on reforms within and across different jurisdictions. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. And if you look back at often when really meaningful reforms being achieved, it is in the wake of crises or traumas that you know, populations that have changed the way populations might look at current affairs, might look at politics, and might look at the entities that govern them, you know?
That's very true.
I think it's also important to point out that these changes will have to be you know, it's not just a question of 27 leaders coming into a room and making a deal and that, and that's that. They have to be worked and implemented, and they have to gain the democratic assent of the electorates in all of these 27 states. Not that people will be voting on this in a deal in a plebiscite or anything like that, but they'll all be facing elections sooner or later. And so you look at, you know, there's an election in Holland next year in which Eurosceptic parties will be criticizing this deal and possibly promising to back out of it. There will be, I think, ground zero for the future of the European project along these lines. Does it continue along the lines at the weekend, or does it go into reverse? Would be the French presidential election in 2022. If Marine Le Pen is elected in that, I suspect it's, you know, not just full-scale reversal on these changes agreed at the weekend, but ultimately possibly a time bomb at this very heart of the EU as a project. So, you know, there are very significant political challenges for the governments and the parties in member states who have agreed this deal to secure the assent of their electorates for it. And that, I suspect, will be an ongoing battle for all of them.
I mean, speaking of crisis and our own reactions to crisis here, we're still waiting on the full unveiling, announcement, reveal, whoever you describe it, of this major government package of support for the parts of the economy affected by COVID-19. Do we know when it's due? Thursday, Friday? Will we definitely see it this week?
I think we'll see it this week, yeah. There was a meeting of the cabinet subcommittee that is kind of quietly progressing this plan yesterday, and I think it needs to be signed off.
Not so quietly sometimes, but go on.
Not so quietly sometimes, but it needs to be signed off by a full meeting of cabinet. So I think either Thursday or Friday we will see it. And look, I mean, this compared to its stablemate, the Green List, it's been a comparatively stress-free and controversy-free emergence into the world. And you know, I think that there is plenty in this package, there will be in this package that people will be relatively pleased about. You know, a lot of it does kind of boil down to free money, which people tend to like. And we know the broad outline of it. The credit guarantee scheme, $2 billion fund, has already been announced. So there's going to be improved and expanded reopening grants for businesses. There's going to be some kind of green element around retrofit. There's this staycation voucher as well, which is not only potentially free money for businesses, but also free money for people, which people like. And there will be an extension of the rates waiver, and probably something around apprenticeships as well, which will kind of dovetail with the pandemic unemployment payment winding down over time. The idea being that people who are put on this enhanced welfare payment will kind of transition, if they can't find full-time employment, into some kind of enhanced state training scheme, and that may be focused particularly on helping out sectors like the arts, which have been, you know, utterly starved, not only of income in the immediate sense, but also of a business case in the medium sense. So yeah, it's been relatively smooth, but you know, there is also the possibility that, you know, this thing can only disappoint in some ways. If for example it turned out that it would be more difficult than originally envisaged in getting this government cash onto the balance sheets of businesses, I think that would be very problematic. And there has already been instances in the initial incarnation of the credit guarantee scheme and the reopening grants where, you know, because it was funneled through local authorities, it seemed to be slow or officious or bureaucratic, and really this is the kind of big bazooka, and it needs to make its way onto those balance sheets very quickly, because obviously a lot of businesses are facing, you know, fundamental existential issues about whether they're gonna be here in a couple of weeks. There's also this question of a VAT cut, which was kind of doing the rounds a few weeks ago, and certainly seems to have stepped into the background, perhaps to be replaced by some kind of, you know, some kind of VAT goodies delivered through the staycation voucher. Like, a VAT cut is always, it's always called for by, you know, the publicans and the restaurateurs and the hoteliers, but it's always really strongly resisted by the mandarins in the Department of Finance, because they absolutely hate deploying tools like this, because it's very hard to put back in the bag. And they would also argue that there's more efficient ways of getting cash into the business sector. Nonetheless, if that doesn't materialize, because a similar one has materialized in the UK, I think you'll get the usual Sturm und Drang from the businesses, and that'll be kind of a minor controversy that the government will have to look after. But overall, you know, I think it'll be 7 billion worth of free or free-ish money, and there's not a huge amount for people to object to about that, so long as it makes its way from the coffers of the government into their pocketbooks relatively untrammeled.
Yeah, Pat?
Yeah, I think the government really needs this to land well. Now, I understand that some of the division at Cabinet was not just over, or certainly at Cabinet level, not just over the green list yesterday, that there is some divisions over the stimulus package as well. But I think politically, the government cannot afford to have a repeat of the messing of recent days. It needs this to land well and catapult it into the August break, from whence it needs to come out with a plan to open the schools in September. If it does that, then I think, you know, it is set fair for to agree a budget in the autumn and deal with whatever comes out of Brexit. But if it doesn't, if this doesn't land well, and if the government doesn't go on to come out with a viable plan for opening the schools nearly all the time in September, then I think we will find ourselves with a government that is entirely embattled come the autumn.
Let me ask you about the schools, Jack, because Pat talks there about a plan for the schools. We're only 5 weeks away from when schools are supposed to be going back. There's, as lots of people are increasingly pointing out, including Fintan O'Toole yesterday in the Irish Times, and lots of other people as well, there is no sign of a plan. The brand new minister, new TD, Norma Foley, one of the more surprising appointments by Micheál Martin. She stepped into the shoes of Joe McHugh, whose performance was not particularly highly regarded either. Things are not looking good at the moment in that department. And certainly I sense a rising level of anxiety about what plans, if any, are in place for schools.
Yeah, I mean, the schools issue, so there's this kind of trope trotted out, you know, we have a plan for reopening the pubs, we don't have a plan for reopening the schools. I think that cuts through, but I think one of the reasons that we don't have a plan for reopening the schools is that it's a particularly kind of wicked problem. You know, no matter which way you turn, more problems present themselves. And it's going to need a fairly substantial monetary solution on top of everything else. Because like talking to people who were in a meeting with Norma Foley yesterday, there seemed to be some suggestion that, you know, at the moment schools are being asked to do everything that is easily within their gift and power to increase space, and you know, that extended to the removal of cabinets in classrooms. And I mean, that's, you know, just so woefully underpowered a solution to the scale of the problem that it beggars belief. So they need an enormous statement here. They need an enormous plan, and they also need to do it soon. Like I think that in addition actually to the stimulus plan landing well, I think they need to offer a view on the reopening of schools before they break up for August. That entails a big sum of money, and also entails a credible plan on how they're going to do it. Because, you know, they break up for August and the doll goes into recess and so on, but schools are supposed to come back in September. This is not a faraway problem. This is a very much here and now problem. And on top of that, while Norma Foley is regarded as you know, a clever, personable and capable operator, you cannot get away from the fact that she is a first-time TD, that this time a couple of months ago she was on Kerry County Council, and she's been put into a remarkably difficult department at the best of times, facing, you know, seismic challenges at the worst of times, which this is. And we haven't heard a huge amount from her, apart from, I think, what could fairly be described as a kind of car crash interview in the Sunday Independent a couple of weeks ago. There was a controversy last week in the Dáil where she kind of said one thing in response to a direct question from Éireann Reardon, and then, you know, said another thing in a press release shortly thereafter. Apparently that policy change wasn't briefed out to stakeholders, who were very upset about it. And now she kind of seems to be avoiding the Dáil floor in general. She met with opposition spokespeople yesterday rather than answer questions on the floor of the Dáil. So, you know, there is a kind of perhaps growing fear, if not a sense, that, you know, she may not be matched to the challenge. And I think that the government needs to counter that very quickly. And as I say, needs to put a credible plan together in the next 10 days, not in the next 6 weeks.
I mean, this is a problem that lots of countries are having. You see lots of debate about it in the United States, and in many ways they're much worse off than we are in some of what's going on there. They made a dog's dinner of it across the water in the UK a couple of months ago when they tried to make commitments which weren't met. I saw Lara Marlow reporting from us from France on similar problems. But having said all that, Pat, I mean, Jack is absolutely right. You can't wait to unveil a plan till the third week or the fourth week in August. You need to see something and see some financial commitments and see some guidelines and see some directions pretty much now, don't you?
And I get no sense that that is at anything like the stage of planning and progress that you would think it has to be at this stage if it is going to go ahead. That said, I'm constantly assured that there's lots of work underway on it, even if it's sometimes difficult to see it. But I think it's impossible to overestimate the political importance of this for the government. You know, most people don't follow the comings and goings of cabinet, and myself and Jack will be trying to figure out what's in this stimulus plan today and what happened at cabinet last night. Most people, you know, they don't follow the comings and goings of politics like that. But they do pay attention when politics affects their daily lives. So they did sit up and take notice about, you know, the lockdown and the easing of the lockdown. And this is the aspect of the lockdown, along with the closure of businesses, that affects most people in the country. And I think they will be tuned into this right throughout August, whether they're on holidays in Greenland or whether they're down in Ballinskelligs, I think, or whether they're sitting at home wondering if they should be going to Dunn's or Tesco's getting the uniforms for the kids, because they've grown out of the ones that they last wore in February or early March. I think people will be focused in on this. And I think if the government doesn't deliver on it, I think the political consequences will be enormous. Is it possible for them to deliver a reopening of the schools in to a sufficient degree that that keeps people happy? I don't know. You would have thought not without the cooperation of the teachers' unions and the expenditure of very significant amounts of extra money. But neither of those two things should be beyond politics. Whether they are beyond this government, I think we'll see in the coming weeks.
Finally, and it's kind of telling in itself that it's the final item on the agenda. Normally, if you had a coalition government and one of the government parties was in the midst of a leadership election, and that election was due to take place or be finalised, or the result was due to be not finalised this week, it might be the first item on the agenda. So, Pat, this is a very low energy green leadership election, isn't it? There's something slightly surreal about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's something slightly surreal about having a leadership election after you've just had your most successful election in the history of your party anyway. But, you know, they're the Greens' rules, and they've explained that. There's also the fact that this is taking place amongst a relatively small group of people, a couple of thousand Green members. We were all taken hugely by surprise, not that the Green members, these same Green members who are entitled to vote in this election, we were all taken by surprise at the margin by which they approved the programme for government. So what is going on with those members now? It's very difficult to tell. My colleague Harry McGee, who keeps a very close eye on these things, tells me that the last time he checked in on it some days ago, it seemed that turnout was on the low side. Impossible really to say how that's going to affect things. One view is that makes a close outcome more likely. I would have thought perhaps that means that those opposed to Eamon Ryan's leadership after their thumping in the vote on the programme for government might be rather too demoralised or disinterested to try and oust him as leader. I think it would be, notwithstanding the lack of any hard information to go on, I think it would be a bit of a shock if Eamon Ryan was to lose. It would certainly be a jolt to the leadership of the government. And if the kind of confusion at the top of government in recent days tells us anything, I think it tells us that the construction of a strong centre in this government is something that is very much a work in progress, to put it kindly. And I think that this construction of that strong centre within government would probably be set back by a change of leader in the Greens. That having been said, Catherine Martin campaigned for the deal. I think it certainly won't destabilise the government, to a dangerous degree if she wins, but it certainly would add to the uncertainty that the government is facing in the coming days and weeks in relation to all those issues that we've just discussed.
And finally from you, Jack, I mean, if Pat is right and if it's more likely that Eamon Ryan wins, how many tea leaves can be read in the cup of a narrow victory versus a comfortable victory? Say a 52% to 48% as opposed to a over 60% for Eamon Ryan?
Well, I think, first of all, I think it is more likely that Eamon Ryan wins. But, you know, I think Catherine Martin has a relatively strong hand to play here. You know, she campaigned for the programme for government, but she had plenty of surrogates, including her husband, who were campaigning against it. You know, so I don't think that I think that wing of the party that was against the programme for government has nowhere else to go in terms of its voting in a two-horse race. And I think that she's a strong enough candidate to pick off some of the Ryan supporters. In that, you know, she's articulate, she's smart, she's a woman, she's not from Dublin, even though she represents a Dublin constituency, and she doesn't, as insofar as we've seen so far anyway, she doesn't have the kind of Eamon Ryan foot and mouth propensity, you know, to go off or say something silly in the Dáil or fall asleep in the Dáil or, you know, talk about reintroduction of wolves or something like that, which I think may appeal to people. But on the balance of things, I think Eamon Ryan probably will be the leader. You know, I think that the strength of that victory, it kind of doesn't matter in some ways, you know, like, because his leadership will be so solidified then thereafter. And what won't go away will be some of the simmering resentment that is quite clearly there in the Green Party at the moment. Like, it was a fractious debate over a programme for government that ultimately was comfortably passed, but it opened up wounds that haven't healed yet. And there's ongoing allegations and issues around the treatment of some councillors, and, you know, the bullying word has been thrown around. So I think that, you know, no matter who wins the race, but particularly if it's Eamon Ryan, we'll have to kind of triage that situation and pay attention to it. Otherwise, you'll have a kind of small but active rump of the party that is, you know, grumbling about his leadership, if not actively trying to undermine it, and that wouldn't be good for the stability of the Green Party and then for the stability of the government thereafter.
And we'll be getting that result, I understand, on Friday evening. I think it's right to say. We shall leave it there. Thanks indeed to Pat and to Jack for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Suzanne Brennan, and to our engineer, JJ Vernon. Before we go, may I gently encourage you, as always, if you have not already done so, to go to irishtimes.com/subscribe, where you can sign up for unlimited access to the Irish Times for the introductory price of just €1 for the first month. And if you do want to get in touch with us, we'd be delighted to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.